This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the distinct pleasure of chatting on today's program with the co-creator of the Zero Aggression Project, Mr. Jim Babka. Jim also serves as president of the Downsize DC Foundation, as well as Downsize DC. You can get more information on Downsize DC at downsizedc.org. Jim, we were talking in the last segment about the Zero Aggression Principle. So talk about what the Zero Aggression Project is going to accomplish.
I would say that the number one thing for us, and maybe I'll make this the top two things, is that we want to start a dialogue that softens opposition to our position and finds and activates people who already agree with us. The simple math here is, if you believe that the federal government or your state government are doing too much, if you believe that they're spending too much of your money, that they're engaging in too many wars, that they're regulating you in ways that are unacceptable, whatever it is, then you're going to basically agree with our approach, at least to some degree. And you're certainly going to agree with our direction. And the problem for us has been is there's not enough of us who believe strongly that the state does way too much. We are outnumbered. We are outranked. And this is the problem that comes up again and again. If there were more of us, there would be more money. There would be more candidates. There would be more activists. There would be more of us just simply standing up and objecting to the things that are happening, and maybe even proposing better ways of doing things through voluntary engagement with one another. And so our goal is really to find those people and to activate those people. Our goal is to soften resistance and even persuade people over to our position, so at the end of the day, there are more of us.
So, Jim, when you talk, it's just those positions, I think, are positions that resonate certainly with most of our listeners. And yet, when you look at the number of folks that are dependent upon government, dependency, many people would argue, makes people apathetic as to what actually happens as long as they get what's coming to them. And I could probably put quotation marks around that, coming to them. What are the chances that we can actually get some meaningful change?
Well, there's a number of different things, ways that meaningful change can come about, and it just kind of depends on the area. Let me give you an example that may or may not appeal to some members of your audience, but I happen to believe that the war on drugs is a tremendous failure. And a lot of these stories that we're seeing now about police violence and issues with authority have to do with the fact that there's a general disrespect for the law. And the disrespect for the law stems from the fact that the law is doing things that it is not empowered to do. It's not just drug prohibition, but at the outgrowth of this, one of them has been asset forfeiture laws. So police departments, sheriff's departments, highway patrols, and federal government agencies are funding some of their efforts by confiscating property from citizens, oftentimes people who just happen to have cash on them or some other possession. They're just taking this stuff and declaring the property guilty without, because it's presumed guilty until it can be proven innocent. I don't know how you examine a property and cross-examine such a property, allow it to be defended. I don't understand how all that stuff works, but this is how asset forfeiture is going in this country. And we have a high, high rate of imprisonment, people coming out of prison for nonviolent drug offenses who cannot get a job. And so we see there's social problems, there's problems with authority in the police department, there's problems with people's property being taken. And most people will tell you at the end of the day that they don't believe that prohibition works, that the drug war has been successful. Do we have to go to Washington to change things? Well, many states have found that through ballot initiative and referenda, they've been able to change the law in their state. So they didn't have to go to Washington to get it done. They didn't have to go to their state to get it done. They were able to make a dramatic improvement at home using a tool that was available to them. But that tool is only available in 23 states. What if there was a tool that you, as just a single individual who now understands with a firm moral conviction that cannot be moved, that there's a principle at stake here, that this zero aggression principle matters so much that if you're on a jury, you'll hang a jury if that's what it takes when someone comes before you charged with a nonviolent drug offense? How long would prosecutors continue to pursue these cases if they knew that a jury is likely to be hung by just one out of 12 members of the population who happen to have been called for jury duty? So change can come in a lot of different forms, and it can even come when there's only one of us. But what is required for that person to stand up in that jury room is a firm moral conviction, and that's why we have to have a moral philosophical argument.
So, Jim, let's talk about some of the tools now that your organization have developed. Explain what people will find on the website.
Yeah, let me start with the one that we actually have available now. There's more coming, but I just want to start today, Dennis, with the one that we have available now. And that is that there are going to be people who think that there are exceptions to the zero aggression principle. They're going to have an issue that they think, well, I agree with you on, you know, these 8 or 9 out of 10 things, but there's this one over here that, you know, it's an exception. We can't follow zero aggression principle. That would be unrealistic. And it could be for whatever reason. They could have moral, they could still have a remaining moral objection. They could have a philosophical objection. They could have a pragmatic objection. They may just have a fear-based objection. Whatever that objection is, we want to begin to address that issue specifically. So we have created something we call polling campaigns. These are surveys that people take. They're made up of multiple panels designed to answer the questions that are most on people's minds. And what we're doing within this tool that is so unique that should be valuable to anyone who is in general agreement with our cause is that for the very first time, we are taking in answers and measuring people's movement either for, and here's the important part, or away from our position. We're not threatened by the fact that our arguments may actually have the reverse effect. We can learn from that. Obviously, our goal is to bring in as many people who are moving towards our position as possible. And so there's a vote, there's a slider at the bottom of every one of these panels after we've presented our case. And these are all very short panels for the most part. People get the basic argument, find out a couple of facts, and when they're done with that material, they can vote. They can take a position, then move on to the next panel. At any point they want, they can skip to any other questions so they can find the objection or the portion of the objection that interests them the most, get their most important question about that, about this particular exception answered. And we've posted an example for people to see how this works and to interact with themselves. Our very first polling campaign is the drug prohibition campaign. As I'm talking to you right now, we are just a couple of days away from launching one on Social Security. So people will be able to go in and they'll be able to digest this information. And we, of course, start with the zero aggression principle. And then we begin to apply the principle of force, show how it works, and ask if you would want to be the person carrying out that force, personalize it, emotionalize it, and focus on the morality of it. And then we go, our last question in the opening section is what we call our check writing question, which is, would you pay for it? If you, Dennis, how many programs that we have going on that maybe people are for in general when they're out there voting the population, but if they had to sit down and write a check for it every month, like they, you know, like a membership do, yeah, I want more regulation of drugs. Yes, I want more regulation of corporations. Yes, I want more, I want higher taxes, you know, whatever. They'd have to sit down and write a check. I want more doors kicked in by the DEA. They'd have to write a check for those services. Would they do it? And from there, we get into what are more of the pragmatic arguments that are typical in these kind of discussions, but we do it in a different frame. We keep increasing the cost of the program. We keep showing the negative side effects of the choice to use force. And then we ask the question again if they still want to pay for it. So we're trying to have a very different type of conversation here. The tool's there to facilitate that conversation. You can share it with friends. You can share individual panels, individual portions of these arguments with friends. So it will become a resource library as well. But at the end of the day, the thing that I'm most excited about is that we actually are measuring our arguments and the effect that they're having. And so I would encourage people to come to the Zero Aggression Project. They can just look at the top navigation tool there and click on the appropriate button, which is what do you think? And then they will see the list of any campaigns that we have available. And by the time this broadcasts, I believe there'll be two of them, drug prohibition and Social Security, to get the ball rolling.
And Jim, clarify the web address for our listeners, please.
Yes, it's zeroaggressionproject.org.
Okay, I encourage the listeners to check it out. Jim, let me just ask from a developmental perspective, what gave you as one of the co-creators of the Zero Aggression Project the idea to invest all this time and all these resources in the project?
Well, you know, we've noticed that there's been a change in the dynamic about how these issues are discussed and viewed compared to when I first started. I've been full-time in some form of activism since the late 90s, and I've been full-time employed as a CEO in these kind of efforts since 2001. And so, I was just being out there entrepreneurially, trying a number of different things. In 2004, we launched Downsize DC. And about 2007 timeframe, when Ron Paul got into the presidential race, a different type of dialogue began to emerge on a number of different issues. And the people who were attracted, who had not paid any attention to politics before, that got involved, kept studying the issues. What was motivating Ron Paul's campaign? What was his philosophy? And as they began to dig deeper and deeper into this, they got exposed to sources and ideas that were quite a bit different. And they went even further than simply being a mere voter. They started embracing a viewpoint of the world that largely sees people as equals, largely believes that violence is not the very first resort to solving a problem. And they believe in this, therefore, in this zero aggression principle. And so, but we did notice, as we were approaching this, that they weren't using it when they were having conversations with people. They weren't leading with it. And we began to ask ourselves why. I know we're short on time, so I'm not going to get into it, but there are two innovations that we have brought to this unique argument about how it should be presented, the type of objection you're going to face, and the responses that should be provided to it. They deal with the question of anarchy, and they deal with the question of empathy. And as time goes by, people will see how we're dealing with that. But everything that we're doing is constructed on bringing these two innovations to the table and then encouraging people who believe in this value to begin actually leading with it, to share it openly, and to do so with confidence. And so we felt that the time was right for this and that we had something new to bring to the table and that we could also provide a set of tools that would make people even more effective at it. So we set to work to get this done. It was a tool that Perry Willis, my partner, and I both felt we wanted. Members of our team said, gee, it would be great if we had that. And we just looked in the mirror and said, let's get it done.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. The website is zeroaggressionproject.org. You can also go to downsizeddc.org to learn more about the work that Jim does. Jim, appreciate you being on the program today. Love to have you back.
I always look forward to it, Dennis. Thank you.
Glad you decided to listen in today. In this segment, I want to talk a bit about the United States stock market. Stocks are entering their seventh year of a bull market. In fact, March marked the six-year anniversary of the market bottom. Since that time, markets are up significantly. In fact, the NASDAQ now is back over 5,000, the first time that's happened in 15 years. And the question we want to investigate in this segment, the question we want to explore is this bull market going to continue? Well, we can look at indicators and look at what's happened historically. And of course, just because something's happened historically doesn't mean it will happen again. But it's very interesting to take a look at indicators. And indicators seem to tell us that investors today are very, very bullish. Newsletter writers are very, very bullish. These are investment newsletter writers are very, very bullish. And since the crowd is usually wrong, often this extreme bullishness occurs at or near a market peak. Now, in this segment, I want to walk you through just a few of these indicators, but more importantly, I'll give you some ideas that you might consider using to potentially protect yourself if the market is indeed at a top. The first indicator that I want to talk about is an indicator called the Investor's Intelligence Bulls to Bears Ratio. This indicator basically tells us what financial newsletter writers are advising their readers. Now, if you take a look at this indicator and go back and look at it really since the 60s, only really a couple times has the indicator been more bullish than it is today. And it is more bullish than it has been at any time in the last 30 years. If you look at the numbers, basically any number over 75 is considered to be very bullish. Any number below about 40 is considered to be very bearish. Well, at the market bottom, for example, in March of 2009, this bulls to bears ratio was actually about 35. When you look at the bear market of 73 and see the bottom that occurred in about 75, this indicator was at about 33. So at market bottoms, this is a pretty accurate predictor. And then at market tops, if you take a look, for example, at where this indicator was at the market top in 1999, it was about 65. At the market top in 2000, this indicator was at about 70. And today, this ratio is at 80. It hasn't been this high in 30 years. So what this tells us is the overwhelming majority of investment newsletter writers are bullish. And again, the crowd is typically wrong according to what we see historically. In fact, these newsletter writers are 82% of them are bullish on U.S. stocks and only 18% are bearish. Now, the second indicator I want to talk about is an indicator that tracks the price of the 25 cheapest stocks in the S&P 500. So this would be the 20th percentile. There's 500 stocks that make up the S&P 500. We're looking at the cheapest 20. So if we take a look at where this level is and take a look at the cheapest stocks, and again, we use numbers for a reference point, this tool has given a pretty accurate buy or sell signal depending on the number value of these cheapest 20 stocks. Buying opportunities have traditionally taken place when the indicator is below 6. In 2009, at the market bottom, this indicator was at 4. The market bottom in 2002, this indicator was at about 4.5. Conversely, a sell signal often occurs when it is at 17 or higher. If you go back to 1999, this indicator was at about 22 prior to the market correction. In 2007, 2008, it was at about 17. Today, it's at 20, and it's been over 20 for several months. So this is the highest number, the highest overbought signal in its history, close to the highest overbought signal. It's almost where it was at the market correction that began at the end of the tech stock bubble back in 1999. The third indicator that I want to talk about is the number of IPOs, or initial public offerings, that are unprofitable. This is a pretty interesting indicator and a pretty valuable indicator to look at, in my opinion, because as markets heat up, more and more companies make an initial public offering. In fact, this past week, Fitbit made a public offering that was successful. Well, the more public offerings that are made, the more IPOs that are made, the more of them that will tend to be unprofitable. And if you look at the percent of unprofitable initial public offerings and look at where it was again at prior market peaks, in 1999, 76% of initial public offerings were unprofitable. And you have to think about what was happening at that time. This was the end of the tech stock bubble. Many of these tech stock companies, these dot-com companies, didn't even have any earnings, and yet they went public anyway. In 2007, near the market peak, 65% of initial public offerings were unprofitable. Today, we have surpassed the percentage of initial public offerings that are unprofitable that existed back in 1999. In 1999, 76% of initial public offerings, as we've already stated, were unprofitable. Today, 78%. Then we take a look at price-to-sales ratios of stocks. We look at the price of a company's stock, and we look at the company's sales. And if you take a look at this number again, back in 1999, look at the number in 2007, you see that in 2007, the price-to-sales ratio was even higher than it was in 1999, and today it is even significantly higher than it was in 2007. So this reinforces the notion that the stock market is priced at an excessive level. Some would even argue an outrageous level. Here's another indicator that, if you think about it, makes sense, but it's something that you probably wouldn't immediately think of as an indicator that you wanted to use to determine the valuation level of the stock market. When you look at quantitative easing, when you look at the money printing that's occurred, many markets, as a result, have become overbought. They've become inflated. Asset price bubbles exist. We believe this exists in the stock market, but it also exists in the art market. When you look at art auctions, which typically are more prevalent in the spring, purchases of fine art at the spring art auctions this past year reached the largest dollar amount in recorded history. Historically speaking, the correlation between the art and stock markets is very high, and what it tends to indicate is there's excessive speculation in the system. So if you just take a look at May of 1999, there were 290 million dollars of art sold. 2007 was 531, today 585. And then finally, even though the market has continued to go higher, when you take a look at the number of stocks making new highs and compare the number of new stocks making new lows, you get something else that makes us think that the market may be at or near a top. When markets are reaching new highs, we want a number of stocks to also be making new highs. It tends to indicate that the market is moving lockstep, that there's a lot of participation as the market moves higher. That is not the case today. The number of new highs compared to new lows has been declining since 2013. So for about 2 years now, we have seen the number of new highs continue to drop off as compared to new lows, which tells us there may not be enough participation in the market as well. If you'd like to get our complete economic and stock forecast, it's very easy to get your hands on our Investors Discovery Kit. All you need to do is go to the website, investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com. Just enter your name and address. We'll be glad to send you our Investors Discovery Kit free of charge and without any further obligation. You'll receive a copy of the book, New Retirement Rules. You'll also receive a copy of the New Economy Magazine, as well as an educational CD and DVD. So again, to get your copy of the Investors Discovery Kit, just visit investingapproach.com. That concludes our second podcast for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Tune in again next week. Bye.